We now focus on a number of global issues, and we're joined by Scott Lucas, founder and editor of EA Worldwide, a professor at the University of Birmingham in the United Kingdom. Scott chats to us from the United Kingdom. Scott, good day, greetings, and welcome to the program.
It's always such a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Scott, we've seen the story emerging of an attempted hijacking in Oman, or the Gulf of Oman. What is the story behind, and why is this dominating news at this point? What are some of the developments that you can share with us in this regard?
Well, the immediate story is that yesterday afternoon in the Gulf of Oman, that waterway through which 20% of the world's oil passes, there was a Panamanian flight tanker. Now, this wasn't an oil tanker. It carried bitumen, asphalt, the Asphalt Princess, it was called. And it was boarded by, estimates range from 5 to 6, all the way up to 9 gunmen, heavily armed gunmen. At the same time that it was boarded, there were 4 other ships that reported they had lost control. In other words, we don't know why they lost control. Did they lose communications? Did their engines fail? Were they in fear of being hijacked? Anyway, the upshot of this is that overnight, this one ship, the Asphalt Princess, was being taken towards Iran. Reports were coming out from British sources, British maritime sources, that it was an Iranian-linked group, possibly the Iranian armed forces, that were detaining the ship. Now, this morning, the gunmen left the ship. It began to reverse course, to move back towards Oman. But we're left with one of two scenarios. One is that some faction, unknown gunmen, for some reason, stopped the world shipping for several hours by boarding the ship. The second scenario is that, yes, this was the Iranian military, the Revolutionary Guards, who tried but failed to detain the ship. Why would they do that? Well, the background of this, we need an entire program for it, but it is that we have really got a war on shipping, indeed a hybrid war between Israel and Iran, that Israel, for more than a decade, has assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists, attacked Iranian nuclear facilities, carried out cyber operations. Israel has attacked Iranian ships, including those taking oil to Syria. So Iran is striking back by attacking shipping, including ships that are linked to Israel. For example, one last Thursday called the Mercer Street in a drone attack in which 2 crew were killed.
Yeah, so this is really a significant development. And staying with the issue of Iran, we see that Raisi's inauguration as new Iranian president tomorrow. How big a deal is this?
Well, it's a big deal always when you have a change of government, but you have the immediate change, which is that from a more centrist president, President Rouhani, who with the foreign ministry have really been pursuing diplomacy, including the nuclear talks with other powers, including the United States. Raisi, who was the head of judiciary, is more of a hardliner. Now, he was selected by the Supreme Leader's Office to win in what was a managed election in June. So the question is, does this mean a much harder line, that Iran will step back from the nuclear talks and indeed will continue to endure U.S.-led sanctions? But let's link up that presidential inauguration tomorrow with what happened yesterday. Does this mean that the Supreme Leader's Office, which is working with the Revolutionary Guards, along with President Raisi, now not only will be much tougher in their diplomacy, but they actually will risk a confrontation with Israel and with the West? We have to wait and see, but I think this is probably the most difficult period in relations with Iran since 2019.
Yes. Then coronavirus, Delta variant, and vaccine hesitancy. What's the reason? Disinformation?
Well, I think whether in the UK, where I am, whether in the US, where my relatives are, whether in South Africa, where you are, you see that a lot of people will not take vaccines, even in a pandemic, which, you know, is the first one that we've had in a century, and in which hundreds of thousands of people, indeed millions of people, more than 4 million, have died. Why is that? Well, sometimes there can be religious reasons for not taking a vaccine. Sometimes there can be fear about what a vaccine's effects will be. But what has really accelerated this in the age of social media is the disinformation about the vaccine. The coronavirus vaccines, which are between 80 and 95% effective in preventing the contraction of coronavirus, which are almost 100% effective in preventing hospitalization and death. But people hear these stories that are put out by anti-vaxxers and by coronavirus deniers, that you'll be controlled by Bill Gates or George Soros if you take the vaccine, that the vaccine has these absolutely deadly side effects, that it is all part of a plot by governments to control us. None of this is true. But in a very uncertain world where it's very difficult sometimes to understand the science of coronavirus, people get scared. I think in the UK, where we have more than 90% of people who've taken a first dose, more than 90% of adults who've taken a first dose, I think the tide has turned in favor of dealing with this. In the United States, my country, where only about 60% of American adults have been fully vaccinated, it's a much more difficult proposition, especially with the Delta variant surging in the United States as it is doing in other countries.
Yes, that is really an issue. Tunisia's latest in terms of the power conciliation, what's going on there?
Sorry, the power conciliation in which country?
In Tunisia.
In Tunisia, sorry, we move around the world and I sometimes lose my place. But in Tunisia, we're talking about President Saeed, who a few weeks ago just simply suspended parliament, got rid of the prime minister. In effect, all of those institutions that we were talking about the 2011 revolution in Tunisia at the start of the so-called Arab Spring, they were swept aside. In what is not quite martial law, President Saeed is not a general. He's not the head of a military, but he, in effect, is trying to exert full authority. Now, this means it's a very uncertain time in Tunisia. Does this mean that we, in effect, have a permanent or a long-term suspension of elections, of the process by which you have a parliament? Does it mean that all institutions must be subjected to the will of the president? I emphasize there are reasons why this has occurred. Tunisia has had a downturn in its economy. It contracted 8% last year. Unemployment is about 17%. It has been hit, like many countries, by the economic as well as the deadly effects of coronavirus. But I think to look at Tunisia, which many people thought, in contrast to Syria and Egypt, here's one place where we had a peaceful transition of power after 2011, to see where we are now, it really highlights that I think no country in any part of the world is immune from the problems or the challenges of what might be authoritarianism.
Yes. And then we move on to another issue that has come up as a result on the sideline of the Olympics. Belarus athlete that made the world headlines recently. But what's the darkest story or the darkest side of the Belarus story that hasn't been given the coverage that it due, it necessary?
Well, so we had the story of the Belarusian 200-meter runner who, because there was a falling out with her coaches, it looked like she faced retribution, because you can get political retribution that ends your sporting career and that possibly can threaten your personal security. So she has asked for asylum. She was protected by Japanese police at the airport, and she now at this point has a visa to go at the moment to Austria, to go to Poland. We'll see if she winds up there. But while that story was unfolding, what I found interesting is that on Monday, one of the leading Belarusian activists, a man named Mr. Shishkov in Kiev, based in Ukraine, who was helping other Belarusians get out of the country when they were at threat of being detained or possibly worse by authorities, he is found dead in a park in Kiev, and it appears he might have been murdered. Now, that is a story that does not make as many headlines because he was not an Olympic athlete. He simply was the head, or at least one of the key figures, in a Belarusian opposition movement which continues to fight for rights and reforms. But it appears, it is alleged, that President Lukashenko and his security forces, they've gotten him and killed him. This shows how serious it is for anybody fighting for rights and reform in Belarus. It highlights the risk that they're taking.
Yes. And then the good news story, U.S. Afghan withdrawal 20 years later.
I wish it was a good news story. I think it will be presented as a good news story by the Biden administration that after 20 years, after 9/11, after the Taliban were pushed out of Kabul, that American troops can come home. Troops of other countries are coming back as well. The international coalition is stepping down. But to call it a good news story to say that the boys are coming home ignores the fact that it's Afghans who are on the front line. I'm not saying that the Taliban will entirely take over the country, although they control more than half of it. But in recent weeks, the Taliban have pushed back Afghan security forces. There have been hundreds, thousands of Afghan security forces who have been killed or captured or even fled the country, for example, to neighboring Tajikistan. And the question of, are we looking at an attempt not for a political resolution between the Taliban and the Afghan government and other factions? Are we looking at another phase in what is a protracted civil war? I think it's a useful reminder that for all the talk of, you know, America, all the talk of other countries in the region, whether it's Iran or Pakistan or Uzbekistan or Tajikistan, you know, it's the Afghan people themselves who first and foremost are really bearing the brunt of what happens in terms of the instability for their day-to-day lives.
Yes, it really comes down to that in the end. Thank you very much, Scott. Your time always appreciated on Radio Islam.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a lovely day. Bye-bye.